My name is Jeff Harbach. I'm the CEO of Coffin Fellows and the host of the Coffin Fellows podcast. This season, our podcast is produced in partnership with Mighty Capital and features different Coffin Fellows as co-hosts. In this podcast, we dive deep into the personal narratives of some of the most successful names in the venture capital industry. But we're not here just to explore their highlight reels, however impressive they are. From failures and formative learning experiences to inflection points and aha moments, we discuss the real, authentic journeys that each individual goes through to become the best version of themselves in order to best serve the entrepreneurs they invest in. Covering various themes in venture capital investing, we speak with the world's top leaders in capital formation, all from a place of authenticity and vulnerability. Together, we'll unravel what truly makes a great venture capital investor. Now let's meet today's host and their guest.
Hi, I'm S.C. Moadi, founding partner of Mighty Capital, and I'm excited to host this series on the age of product. Let's hear from my guest today. So let's get started. And Melody, it's really a pleasure to have you as my guest today. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me, SC. So I'm Melody Koh, partner at NextView Ventures. We're a C-stage focused firm. I'm based in New York. A quick introduction on my end. I've been at NextView for almost 4 years. We are a C-stage pre-seed investor where we usually lead rounds, co-leads, and invest across the C-stage spectrum. And I've done both consumer B2B as well as some marketplace investments since I got here. Most recently, before coming back to venture investing, I was head of product at Blue Apron. I joined the company when we were about 18 months old business, 20-person startup as a first product hire, and was fortunate enough to help scale the business and build out product management, design, analytics, data science teams through IPO. I was there for almost 4 years as well. The business kind of was, my whole time was there, you know, grew basically kind of straight up to the right, and as pretty intense scaling exercise. We probably grew about 25x in terms of revenue and probably corporate headcount when I was there. And before that, I had done product stint at another e-commerce company in New York called fab.com. And then had also been a founder of a C-stage wine e-commerce business when I was in business school and raised a little bit of seed money, went through Accelerator. So I kind of both kind of 0 to 1 experience as well as probably like 10 to 100, I guess, from an operator side, and started my career in finance, in banking. And then my second job was actually in venture. So I had also fortunate enough to being exposed to venture investing at an earlier part of my career. I was at Time Warner and the venture team in New York doing Series A, Series B investments broadly across digital media. So yeah, so that's me. Glad to be here.
Awesome. Well, let's start by rewinding the clock and going back to the Blue Apron day when you and I were prepping. I asked you like, hey, I'd love for you to share the role investors played at Blue Apron. You said, you know what? We were a rocket ship. Like the best thing they could do was to stay out of the way. Tell us a little bit about that. What makes a great investor when it's a rocket ship type situation? And now when you look at your work at NextView, where you're involved with seed stage founders and you get, you know, kind of really to play the role of a thought partner with them, how's mm-hmm. that different? What are some of the things you've learned?
Yeah. So to give people a little bit of context, even though the business, so when I joined Blue Apron, like I mentioned, it was an 18-month-old business. And I say this is one of those very rare situations that they probably had product market fit from day one. And at the month I joined, we were doing $50 million run rate. And 9 months later, we were at $100 million run rate. And we barely had marketing when I first started. So this was like a different scale. You know, thinking about today's world, this is a very different scale of business than your average 18-month-old company. So, you know, I think when we were prepping SC, I mentioned that like most of my interactions with our investors were really kind of later when I rose to become head of product at a board meeting level, because, you know, functional leaders go in to present during board meeting time. And I think that like probably very, very, very early days, you know, first couple months post-launch, my guess would have been that the investors probably had more you know, tactical level interactions and advising with the team. And obviously, you know, probably chimed in a lot on like how to think about hiring and stuff like that. The other context is also that like Matt, the founder CEO of Blueprint, he was in venture before. So he was an investor at Bessemer before he started the company. So he kind of, I say he's not a repeat founder, but he knew the game. So I think because of that experience and because actually one of the two lead investors in the company was Bessemer, basically his former employer and boss, they had a different type of relationship than your average founder VC relationship. So I think, you know, Matt had a pretty tight control of like how we're executing and it has a very strong point of view as a founder, CEO. So I think the relationship probably was more like, especially when everything was clicking, you know, investors are just, you know, they can be more helpful in terms of introductions to other leaders, you know, kind of anticipating the next stage of growth across functional areas, maybe some advice on like different type of technology stacks and the choices of that, but not necessarily like at a tactical level. And really, you know, try to stay out of the way and just let the team execute. We are C-stage investors. So when we invest, I'd say half the time, the companies are either pre-launch or pre-product. The other half of the time, the companies might be doing 10K, 20K, MRR, maybe at the very, you know, later stage end of the seed spectrum, they can be doing maybe a couple hundred K a month in revenue, but those are pretty rare. So most of these, 95% of these companies are in search of product market fit. So I think the way I and my partners, the way we work with founders is, I would say it's a combination of being a higher level strategic thought partner, as well as, you know, every one of us has prior operating experience. So sometimes we can be helpful on a tactical level as well. But I think it's just because you're searching for product market fit and business is not set yet, there's a lot of iteration involved at a pretty high velocity. And that's really when we think it's very helpful for someone to be, you know, kind of be on the receiving end of bouncing ideas off and gut checking and, you know, help the team see around the corners and think steps ahead as they're iterating through what the actual business and what the actual product is.
Got you. Melody, I hear kind of two completely opposite dream jobs, right? On the one hand, I hear the Blue Apron story where it's like, if I'm an investor in Blue Apron, all I have to do is sit back and do nothing. That's a certain kind of dream job. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, I hear the work you do at NextView, which is another kind of dream job, which is I get to work with all these incredible dreamers, innovators, entrepreneurs, and help them find product market fit. When you think about like what makes a great investor, how do you reconcile the two? Like, what are some of the learnings for you as an investor?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because as someone who's previously built companies before, you know, there are four things a VC does: seeing companies, judging companies, winning deals, and working with portfolio companies. And, you know, I would probably argue that the first three things matter a little more in terms of driving fund level returns than the fourth. However, the fourth is very important because it can help avoid mistakes and accelerate the timeline, but it's not going to, if you invest in a company that never was going to make it, I don't think investor involvement single-handedly changed that trajectory. However, I think about it, like if you can be involved in the right way, you can save a lot of iteration cycles and save time and avoid mistakes, which has its consequences when it comes to the final slope of the trajectory. Maybe the slope is like 10 degrees of change, but not like 90 degrees or 180 degrees of change. But, you know, I would say that like, that's the stuff that I think I personally enjoy a lot. And I think probably other investors who previously had kind of operator or company building experience also really enjoy. Now, going back to your original question of like, what makes a great investor? I think that, you know, I think a couple of things. Like one is venture really is about being contrarian and being right at the same time. And I think that's really hard to do. This is probably the most challenging piece of this job. And the other way I think about that challenge is like, how do you see something that others don't? Maybe they eventually see it. But as a C-stage or early stage investor, the opinions are pretty divergent, right? Sometimes you see a company and other people equally find it exciting and it becomes a hot deal. But a lot of times, you know, if you go back to the history of most exciting companies that turn out to be monsters, they all have a story of they pitched 100 investors and only one said yes, right? So I think it's still a pretty tough exercise early on. And I mean, I obviously haven't solved it, otherwise I'd be on the beach. But I think the things to keep in mind is, this is not original from me, but I've heard of someone somewhere else where someone said that it's really hard for human beings to imagine step functional change at the time scale that could become reality, because human beings are pretty linear. So I think as an early stage investor, especially in technology, that's something that you have to constantly challenge yourself. The other two things, just back to the topic, like what makes a great investor? I think one thing is, you know, you can argue like, oh, market, product, people, how do you prioritize? And I think if you talk to very experienced investors, and certainly this is probably a reflection of us as a firm 10 years in, it's kind of all about the people. So the important skill to continue to hone and get better at is how to be a great judge of people. Obviously, market size is important and product execution and all that stuff, but end of the day, like the chances of a team and a company's ability to succeed probably still comes down to like how that founding team can like iterate and maneuver and be it, you know, we sometimes describe internally a heat-seeking missile to get to the heat and break out. And there are 1,000 different execution steps that stack on top of each other that makes a difference in that final outcome. The last thing I'll call out and I'll stop here is, I also think it's very important, you know, being an investor is a long relationship and a long commitment on both sides with the founder or the founders. And, you know, through this long journey, there's going to be up and down. And I think it's very important for an investor to be steady and have empathy in kind of what the founders and the company is going through. And I think that I feel fortunate that I've had the experience of, you know, operating muscle to kind of wrap my head around that. Certainly I did not have that when I was first doing venture, you know, second job out of college, and that I had no like concept of like what it takes to build stuff and hire teams and build teams and, you know, like kind of the organism of a company and how that feels like. And I think it's important to have that, whether you get it through your personal experience or you get it through working with a bunch of other companies, because I think that's pretty important in the founder investor relationship.
These are awesome insights, Melody. So I want to switch to now today. It's been a few years since you've transitioned from product back into venture. We'd love to hear about this transition, transferable skills, challenges you had to overcome, how you went about it, what you learned. And then as a seed stage, you're a high conviction investor. So how do you build conviction today? And how's that different from before?
Yeah, so it's interesting because when people ask me about transferable skills from product, my first thing I say is like, they're two very different jobs. But as I reflect more on, I think there are certain things that you can tease out. I would categorize them in three buckets. One is as a product person. Two is as a product leader. And I'll elaborate on why those two are different. And three is just as an operator or ex-operator who's had scaling experience through hypergrowth. I think those are slightly different types of learning. So first, as a product person, there are things that I think that becomes more of a second nature for product people that I notice I tend to hone in on when I talk to founders. So things like, what is your value prop? Drilling in on why is, how important is the problem that you're solving, who you're solving it for, you know, the user journey, the user persona, the target segments, and why does it matter? How much does it matter? It might sound pretty straightforward, but, you know, someone on our team noticed that I tend to hone in on those aspects more than my partners who, you know, who have slightly different experiences than me. So that's interesting. The other thing I say that is, you know, when you've done product, you have more of an intuitive sense of how something can be built, how easy or hard it is. So you have a better shot at like assessing the technical aspects of what a company is trying to do. And like I said, half the time we make an investment, it's pre-launch or pre-product. So a lot of my job is like, okay, how plausible is this? And do I think it's easy or hard to build? How do I think about like a lot of product technical degree or not? I don't have a CS background, but I think my ability to suss that out is very, very different than before I'd done product. And I can also see that from someone else on the investment team that who doesn't have that kind of background, and the types of questions that you can ask and engage in discussion with founders is pretty different. And then the last thing as a product person is really like how you have a better ability to judge a team's product thinking. A lot, again, because a lot of times you're investing in a half-baked product, so you're not judging the product itself at its, you know, complete form. But it's important to ask questions and, you know, kind of really drill down to how they think about either roadmap or sequencing and really kind of get an understanding whether they can be successful in that regard. As a product leader, and then I think the most important thing is really like the muscle of hiring. And that comes actually pretty handy when it comes to me helping and coaching portfolio founders as they think about hiring. And I had to hire 30 plus people in 2 years. So I feel like I've had a good practice, had to interview a lot of people, and I think that's probably one of the things every company needs to, companies are built by people. And so it's really important for a founder or founding team to know how to attract and retain talent. And then the other thing as a product leader, I think this is not exactly the same, but it's analogous enough. When you're an investor, you work with a founder, kind of like a coach relationship, if that makes sense. It's not exactly the same as a manager and direct report, but there are aspects of it that are similar. So I think that was also a pretty useful and transferable skill. Last thing is just as an operator who's kind of scaled, help companies scale through hyper growth. That's really about like two things. One is you can anticipate a few steps ahead. Working with C-stage companies, the decisions you make right now, what are the ramifications when if you become successful and scale into hundreds of millions of dollars revenue business, you know, at a couple hundred people. You're like a different organization. So, and that's helpful to help guide some of the decisions that are about to be made today because they have consequences and impact. The other thing I think is probably overlooked, but it's really about like what good looks like. Like by good, I mean both people / talent as well as the quality and the speed of execution. If you're seeing how a high quality version of that has played out over time, then you know that like you need to shoot for higher or you can do better or you need to really kind of not settle for this higher because this is like not going to scale with you and things like that. So I think those are probably the things I would call out. When it comes to challenges of transitioning, I think that as someone who's like been on the building side, an easy mistake is for me to think, oh, well, this idea is pretty compelling. Yeah, they can this if executed well, and then you subconsciously think I'm going to execute it. If you execute it well, then this is like how it can play out. I mean, obviously as an investor, I think our job is to be the optimist as opposed to the pessimist. But I think that can be pretty dangerous because I'm not the person who's going to execute. You know, the team that you're talking to now is the team that's going to execute. So you have to make sure that you're marrying those two together versus just like, oh, in a ideal scenario, this is how the execution can pan out. This is why this is going to be very interesting. And you need to make sure that you're taking into consideration of the ingredients that you're backing as a package. And then the other thing is more like, you know, if you're, I've had to resist from what I would call tactical problem solving in board meetings or just conversations with portfolio founders, because, you know, you're a builder at heart and you get into the problem solving brainstorming mode really quickly. Sometimes that's helpful. Sometimes it's not, because most of the time the teams know better about their business and the nuances of their industries and whether they've thought about it before. So I now try to reframe from that. And I would, if I were to say something, I would say, okay, I'm going to get into a tactical mode, but we're going to get out of it in the next 2 minutes. And I'm just going to shut up after I say this. So that's probably, those are probably the challenges transitioning back to investing. And the last part of your question is about conviction building. This is hard to answer because it's pretty squishy. I say that, you know, most of the time I take a first meeting or a call, I have a threshold that I just get excited about or not excited about. I think going back to the earlier point, it's all about the people. So there's a lot of that's like, am I excited about this team? And do they come across as being excellent and have high like execution quality? And then like, I think there's a little bit, you know, personal interest in terms of everyday user lives that can be redesigned through technology. So that's pretty broad. But I think the other thing that helps me build conviction is if there are areas I've thought a lot about and have a, you know, prepared mind, so to speak. And then I try to do work, obviously, to either disregard my earlier enthusiasm or to confirm my earlier enthusiasm throughout the investing.
There's some pre-work work during the due diligence process that's mostly about getting to know the team and potential for it to achieve greatness, and then supporting them through the portfolio. That's awesome. So now we're coming out of a couple of years of life-changing pandemic. And one of the things that we're seeing is It's been sort of a dog years in terms of digital transformations across industries. So we're seeing an era come up that we call the age of product, where the best product is winning against, you know, infinite distribution, like FANGs, you know, Google, what have you, and virtually free products. Mm-hmm. Amplitude is a great example of that in our portfolio. Mm-hmm. Zoom is obviously like the poster child for this. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what your take is on this. You may, you know, agree, disagree. I'd love to get your perspective since you're on both sides. Mm-hmm. And then if you want to pick an industry, I know you recently wrote about digital health. We can pick that or another industry. And I would love to hear how you see these digital transformation and the age of product in that industry.
So I would say that I somewhat agree. I think it depends on the business. I would say my point of view is that for every type of company, there is a functional area that you need to have a superpower in order to break out. So for consumer social, it's probably product. For B2B SaaS that has more of a sales top-down sales motion, that's probably sales and go-to-market. For something that has more of a bottoms-up sales motion or adoption motion, that's probably, you know, developer / community evangelizing content and how you execute on like the developer facing product. I'm just using developer as an example. But I think my point is that it's dangerous to think about quote unquote best product wins, because I don't actually think that is universally true. I think go-to-market and distribution is very important to consider in kind of alongside that. And I think depends on like also the other dimension is kind of on the spectrum of pure software businesses versus technology enabled businesses, right? I think you can probably argue that the more technology enabled you are on the end of the spectrum, other aspects of your execution matters a lot too, like brand, operation, tightness, and things like that. And maybe on the spectrum is more pure software product, then maybe you're more competing on the head-to-head, you know, whether you can run faster and have a better, smoother user experience. And I've seen kind of both in our portfolio as well. So that's how kind of what I would say about the importance of product. I think though, the last thing I would say before we leave that topic is, I do think it is very important to know, to have like good basic product chops. What I meant by that, regardless whether you're on the technology enables end of the spectrum or the pure software spectrum, because every company is kind of a software company, right? And the ability to deliver, and the bar for user experience is pretty high, whether you're a consumer or B2B. So ability to deliver, at least clear that bar in the way that is, you know, you and me both know everybody's always low on engineer resources. So the discipline and the ability to think alongside prioritization, understanding users, and be able to execute at that level is important regardless of your business model. In terms of picking an industry and thinking about products role, so like I've recently been spending time in like what I would broadly describe as software tooling space, and done some investments in the data side and analytics side, given that I previously ran our analytics team and data science teams at Blue Apron, so I have more of a perspective there. And I'm looking at stuff in like what I would describe as B2B as product components that make developers' job easier. And I think there's still a lot of work to do. You know, just picking the data side for a second, you know, we have the macro thesis is really like every company wants to be making data-informed and data-driven decisions. But I think there's still a significant gap between the speed and the nuance at which the company wants to go at it from a data decision-making perspective across both technical and non-technical users, and what the software stacks can deliver today, whether it's at the BI layer, the visualization layer, or the data infrastructure layer, or warehousing, transformation, all those different layers. I think there's probably still a lot of opportunities to make that easier, faster, more accessible. And then we're not even talking about like, you know, machine learning and the applications of that at a more scalable level across, again, you know, going beyond the hands of a very technical user group. So I think that's pretty interesting. And, you know, you go outside of the data side, there are probably still pockets of opportunities to continue to offload aspects of the product engineering work that you need to do if that's not core to automation or payments or things like that. So I think that's pretty interesting to think about in the next couple of years.
Awesome. Melody, we're going to wrap up this really awesome conversation with a few questions in like a lightning style format. So first of four questions, what are your predictions for the next, pick your horizon, like long-term horizon, 3, 5, 10 years, whatever you want. Give me one or two predictions.
Okay. Maybe I'll pick kind of the medium term, like 3 to 5 years. You know, in the context of COVID, I think that emerging out of this, travel and food/dining could go through a pretty interesting iteration. And I think that's going to be pretty interesting to watch. The other thing I would say on a more of a 10-year horizon is I think there will be pretty interesting developments around climate, sustainability as an area broadly defined. And by that, I don't just mean, oh, new battery technologies or, you know, next generation of kind of renewable energy generation, what people traditionally define as climate tech. I think that what's different now is there is a stronger consumer-facing enthusiasm and awareness to potentially propel some pretty interesting business models to the mainstream. You can think about, you know, the renewed interest of the younger generation in re-commerce, secondhand is already a thing that's happening now. And I think that could potentially become more interesting and more mainstream and allows companies to iterate on their business model at a longer horizon and a more mainstream scale. So that's probably the other quote unquote prediction. But I would say that I think VCs are not necessarily good at predicting, because otherwise we should be building businesses ourselves. I would say most of the time we're inspired by the founders for sure.
Absolutely. All right. We covered this a little bit. Next question is, what makes a great VC investor?
Yeah. You know, like I said, I think we touched on this. The toughest thing is see something that others don't and, you know, be a contrarian and be right. I do think that given our model, we like to be building our own conviction a little bit independent of what others think. And I think I like to, you know, I think that's probably what we bias towards. We touched on this in more detail, but the higher level really just be a great partner to founders and have the empathy to do that and be a true partner for a multi-year relationship.
So. Yeah. Next question, we have two more. What advice do you have for our audience of, you know, VC investors, innovators?
Well, if you're a builder, I think it's a great, very exciting time. Anytime there's a major shift in society, I think that presents a lot of interesting opportunities or a lot of behavioral shifts that happened as a result of COVID, which obviously was a very unfortunate event over the past year and is still ongoing in many parts of the world, and even though the US is slowly emerging. But I think given that, it's a very exciting time to build. And as an extension of that, then I think it's a very exciting time to be in the seat of an early stage investor, because you can help propel some of those. I think that, like I said, I think the earlier point is, I think it's very hard for people, human beings in general, to think about changes in a nonlinear way. And I think I would encourage people to kind of keep that top of mind. I think it's probably a mental muscle you need to exercise constantly to be able to get out of that very linear way of thinking how things unfold. But I think that's probably a useful mental model, whether you're on the investing side or on the builder and innovator side.
Awesome. Melody, last question for you. Obviously, you're one of the smartest people out here in the investing scene. How do you stay sharp, and what are some of the resources, whether it's a book, podcast, something else that inspire you?
Yeah, let's see. So general businessy stuff, I still subscribe to the paper version of Economist. I think I first became a subscriber when I was in college. And honestly, I don't know anyone who actually finishes all their Economists. I'm like constantly in debt because I'm like pile 10. It's just like next to my bedstand. But I still like it whenever I get to read maybe a quarter of it. It's a pretty unbiased global perspective covering a wide variety of topics. I'm not the type who like constantly reads tech stuff and tech stuff only. So I like to, you know, when I'm not working, read something that's a little broader, you know. Ben Thompson's Stratocherry is a pretty good newsletter. He's a very good deep thinker. In terms of podcasts, I mean, you know, Harry's 20-Minute VC is good when you want to hear like what other firms are doing, how other investors think. You know, Patrick O'Shaughnessy's Invest Like the Best. It's not just venture. It's like investing across asset class. I find it interesting to borrow thinkings from different asset class. And I think he does a pretty good job interviewing. Yeah, so those are probably the things that I would highlight. But honestly, there's not enough time to consume and read, especially with kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Well, Melody, I really enjoyed this chat with you. I enjoyed catching up, and thank you for sharing your insights. Anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up?
No, thanks for having me. Hopefully this was interesting and mildly helpful. But yeah, no, thank you for having me on.
That's a wrap. Tune in next week for another candid conversation on what makes a great VC investor with your host, the Kaufman Fellows.